Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 26th of January, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's start off our look at what the heck is going on around the nation and around the world this week with an admittedly disgusting reminder of just how far into the police state Gestapo mentality the formerly free United States has now fallen. When a pre-dawn SWAT team raid on the house of former Trump confidant and friend Roger Stone was executed, literally, by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in response to the bogus Mueller witch hunt. And CNN, evidently having been tipped off, was there to record the whole sordid event and transmit the whole perp walk live to their salivating audience, which was obviously thrilled to see about a dozen heavily armed, bulletproof vest-wearing, I'll say it, thugs swarm around the suburban home under pre-dawn cover of darkness and haul the 67-year-old white-haired gentleman off to the gulag. It's all about inspiring fear, of course, especially in those who haven't yet rolled over for the Inquisition. The Mueller press release says former Trump advisor Roger Stone, under scrutiny by the special counsel over his alleged contacts with WikiLeaks. Hey, you better not go to that website yourself, folks, or you too might get a pre-dawn SWAT visit, has been arrested in Fort Lauderdale, Florida on a 7-count indictment. They like to throw the book at him, of course. 1 count of obstruction, 5 counts of making false statements. Only Big Brother's preferred folks can do that, clearly. And 1 count of witness tampering, which, again, you can only get away with if you work for the FBI. Or the DNC, but perhaps I repeat myself. The arrest, like many of Mueller's high-profile arrests, occurred really early on a Friday. And says zero hedges coverage, it isn't exactly a surprise. Stone has long said he expected to be arrested by Mueller and company. The only question was what they'd trump up to accomplish it. And as of press time, there was no word on how many other ham sandwiches were indicted along with him. Lots of commentators, while not in the least surprised, did weigh in on the latest police state tactics. The president himself, at Real Donald Trump, said, quote, "Greatest witch hunt in the history of our country. No collusion. Border coyotes, drug dealers, and human traffickers are treated better." Who alerted CNN to be there? Jack Posobiec said the FBI Special Ops pre-dawn raid of Roger Stone for process crimes and the tip-off of CNN is a sad day for America. CNN, he continued, is literally on the side of the police state left. And he added, perp walks are a feature of witch hunts. Former CNN correspondent Greta Van Susteren noted, too, that CNN cameras were at the raid, so obviously, she concluded, the FBI tipped off CNN. And even if you don't like Stone, she continued, it's curious why Mueller's office tipped off CNN instead of trying to quietly arrest Stone. Quiet arrests are more likely to be safe to the FBI and the person arrested. Let's just be blunt here, Greta. None of this has anything to do with safety or especially good police practice. And if they'd killed Roger Stone, the only thing they would have gotten was more fear in those who they'll go after next. The whole point was a high-profile, big media circus. Liberal journalist Glenn Greenwald weighed in on the high-profile arrest, too, noting it's possible this tip-off came from FBI rather than Mueller's office, but either way, nobody should be comfortable with law enforcement engineering with media outlets the filming of someone's arrest at their home, like a reality TV circus. But, he added, it's Roger Stone, so few will care. Well, Glenn, certainly some care, and CNN caters to them, like rabid dogs with raw meat. Even some on the left are concerned by the implications of this latest example of overreach in the name of a political witch hunt. In a Friday appearance on Fox News Channel's America's Newsroom, well-known and admittedly far-left, although given what we've been watching lately, maybe that doesn't mean what it used to, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz weighed in on Roger Stone's arrest, saying it's typical from FBI Special Counsel Mueller in the Russia investigation because it's a crime, as he put it, that was committed as a result of the investigation rather than as a crime of collusion. And unfortunately, folks, as he's pointed out, there really isn't any such thing as a crime of collusion in the purest sense. There are, of course, criminal conspiracies, but as we've seen, that will get you nominated to run for president, or at least an office on the 7th floor of the J. Edgar Hoover building. Said Professor Dershowitz, Mueller's found almost no crimes that occurred before he was appointed special counsel. He was appointed special counsel to uncover crimes that had already occurred. But he has virtually failed in that respect in every regard, said Dershowitz. Almost all of his crimes that he's indicted people for are crimes that resulted from his investigation. False statements, tampering with witnesses, obstruction of justice. He continued, these are crimes that are generated by the investigation. It doesn't make him any less criminal, but it really means there has been a failure to uncover the basic crimes for which he was appointed. Namely, before he was appointed, was there illegal collusion, illegal conspiracy with Russia? We don't find that. Obviously, he's not counting Uranium 1, and neither is the Mueller witch hunt. And he was a participant, so it's no wonder. And Dershowitz went on to explain that the reasoning behind arresting people like Roger Stone and before that Paul Manafort et al. Is to, quote, get people to sing against the real target of the investigation, President Donald Trump. The obvious purpose, he said, of indicting him, meaning Stone, on these obstructing and false statement charges is to put pressure on him to flip. That's the goal. Will he flip? Nobody knows the answer to that. Michael Cohen said he would take a bullet for the president, and yet he's become his opponent. Stone recently said he would never cooperate and testify, and I take him at his word. But when he's told by his lawyer that he's facing essentially spending the rest of his life in prison, you never know what people will do. Dershowitz noted that the elderly man is likely going to die in prison if they're able to do with him what they intend to do. And then referring to the trophy heads on Mueller's wall, he said, most of the people have flipped so far. These prosecutors have enormous power. They can threaten not only the person, but also his relatives, his friends, and associates, said Dershowitz. Judge Ellis pointed out that in the Manafort case, people like Manafort and Stone are not the real targets of the investigation. President Trump is the target. Stone was eventually released after a $250,000 bid of extortion. In his first public statement since the arrest, Stone asserted that the indictment against him contains no evidence of Russian collusion, gee, there's a shocker, and that Robert Mueller now obviously has more power than the president. Stone's attorney, Grant Smith, was the first person to see him in the booking area of the courthouse and subsequently relayed to InfoWars what his client had said, noting he first asked about the safety of his wife after the stress of the pre-dawn raid. He was told she was okay, and then he gave the attorney his personal thoughts, quote, this country is literally run by a rogue prosecutor who has more power than the president, he said, adding that he believes America is turning into a new Soviet Union and that he fears for his grandchildren, which is, of course, at least part of exactly the kind of terror Mueller seeks to inspire. Echoing that theme, Jacob Engels, a Gateway pundit contributor and longtime friend of Roger Stone, took to Twitter himself to slam what was done in the latest example of political overreach. He said, quote, those claiming for the past 2 years that we live in the Fourth Reich were right. This is a Gestapo state, and Robert Mueller is your Führer. To swat an older man and his wife at 6 a.m. with CNN cameras rolling is something that would make Joseph Goebbels proud. It was the production of propaganda by the special counsel's office that turned FBI agents into modern-day Nazis. Americans, he concluded, need to fight this political persecution with every fiber of their beings, now more than ever. In other news, Friday, the president has announced a tentative deal to reopen the government. Of course, it wasn't ever even 10% shut down anyway. Temporarily. For 3 weeks, up until February the 15th. Is this a Trump cave, or is it more 3D chess? Well, he put it this way. As everybody knows, I have a very powerful alternative, evidently leaving his options open to call that national emergency at long last and build the wall if no deal is reached. He also said he'd look at border technology, including drones. Furthermore, he reiterated it won't be a medieval wall, but a see-through steel smart wall with pre-identified strategic areas like see-through visibility. And then he said, if we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15 again, and yeah, I guess he means partially again, or I will use the emergency powers to address this emergency. We will have great security, said Trump. Stocks are moving lower on the confirmation, said Zero Hedge. And meanwhile, of course, more and more migrant caravans are crossing the southern border of Mexico literally by the thousands at this point and catching their meals and rides for the trip up north. Oh, and in case you're curious, I've looked, but I haven't seen any news yet on whether Nancy will now allow the president to come into the House chambers and give the State of the Union address, or whether she's still worried he may say something he's not allowed to, and therefore will just keep the muzzle on the guy. And I guess this is a good time to recap some of the other shutdown news for the week just passed, starting with a couple of brief comments from Mark Brandley via the Mises Institute, entitled, What Shutdown? No matter how you look at it, and he looks at it a couple different ways, federal spending at most per day is down only about 7%. First, of course, he looks at actual spending based on last year's fiscal year 2018 daily budget and current daily figures through January 18. So he says we've got the first 4 weeks of the shutdown. Let's do the comparison. Last year, fiscal year 2018, the federal government, mostly unconstitutionally, but that's a different story, spent on average about $38.3 billion per day. This year, that average is $41.5 billion. Huh? So yeah, if we define federal spending as total withdrawals from the federal account, average daily spending during the so-called shutdown is 8.5% higher or so, and yeah, you heard that right, higher than it was during the entire fiscal year 2018. Well, though, even though accountants and economists don't like to talk about actual debt and the fact that most of the federal budget is payments on the debt and rolling over a large amount of that debt, yeah, it is a bit like borrowing more money to make payments on your credit card, but Big Brother can get away with that. Most peons can't, and even big businesses that try it generally end up bankrupt, unless, obviously, you're too big to fail and too big to jail. Nevertheless, debt service is still a big deal and worth taking a look at. So for the first 4 weeks of this year through January 18th, federal withdrawals for spending, not including debt service, PDCR, totaled $338.5 billion for a daily average of just over $12 billion. So by this measure of federal spending, compared to fiscal year 2018, Big Brother is spending about 7.3% less per day during the shutdown than they did on average in 2018. No, not exactly massive savings, and certainly not a real shutdown. As the author says, we ought to recognize the deceit involved here in calling this even remotely a shutdown, because spending $12 billion or so a day can't really be called a shutdown. Partial almost doesn't even do it justice, because it's a pretty tiny part. And spending 7% less than you spent last year isn't a shutdown either. But it does at least point out the political corruption of the language. And there's another aspect to all of this, too, but let me introduce it this way. When I was in college, there was a persistent joke running around based on the idea of hazing. Whether it was a pledge in a stereotypical fraternity or maybe a military boot camp, the line goes something like this. After receiving something really unpleasant, for example, a swat on the rear end, the proper response is, "Thank you, sir, may I have another?" And I do have to admit, I think about that every single time I ponder how Americans could put up with transportation sexual abuse. Yeah, TSA. Especially during this tiny, almost unnoticeable, except for some politically correct propaganda, partial government shutdown. Even if it's maybe going to be partially reopened, for a while anyway. And for better or worse, I saw this story from Michael Scott via safehaven.com, which says the government shutdown, they may even have to reset the count at day 35 or so now. It's the longest in U.S. history, unless you count back when we had a constitution and didn't have to have shutdowns like this, because government wasn't nearly as big ever as it still is during the shutdown. Anyway, he says it's resulted in massive, overwhelming media coverage of the transportation sexual abusers, TSA employees, and their fate during the shutdown. Oh, cry me a river. This is precisely because the TSA, he writes, could bring the country to a virtual standstill, as if they haven't already impacted most Americans' desire to ever fly, and thus they have more power than most, it says, to end the shutdown by pressure. Over the last weekend, the holiday weekend, it says, sick calls for TSA employees who are not getting paid during the shutdown anyway, and your host suggests shouldn't ever have been paid in the first place, reached a full 10%, suggesting the problem could spiral out of hand, despite the agency's insistence to the contrary. No, they never lie. Of course, they don't violate your rights either. The full-body microwave oven couldn't possibly be a health problem. They don't steal your stuff, and they don't ever look at or even sell the naked pictures they take. There's plenty of reason for the public sympathy for the TSA, says this guy. Name one, folks. Despite the grueling process, they put travelers through at airports. Still, though, amazingly, though, you won't find this same level of human interest stories about real employees that actually do positive things, whether they be judges, lawyers, well, let's see, maybe not, or other federal workers affected by the shutdown. And whether this is because TSA workers are the worst paid, the most incompetent, the least important, arguably the most unconstitutional, although admittedly that's a tough call, or suggest this guy, maybe it's the 9/11 attacks. Over 51,000 TSA staffers are involved in the airport molestation process. On average, they screen 2 million passengers per day. He doesn't say it, I will. Most of the time, they miss anything important, and they've still never caught a single terrorist.
Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit. You ain't no friend of mine.
And most passengers, says this guy, follow their instructions as if they were in the military, Achtung, because of the security theater that makes them feel safer in doing so. Over the weekend, says the puff piece, TSA even had to close checkpoints at various airports, and even more alarming, it suggests they were forced to call up NDOs, that's National Deployment Officers, to operate the abusive checkpoints because of the absence of screeners over the weekend. Nevertheless, there are plenty of those happy to take their place. In Minnesota, over 300 people showed up gunning for positions at a recent job fair there. Dare I suggest that if you wear your burqa, folks, you probably have a better shot at the job. In the meanwhile, it says, the public, as a result perhaps of all the propaganda, is feeling highly sympathetic towards the poor abuser's plight. Passengers have been dropping off gift cards, say some, bringing in food and making them various offers of assistance. And that's in addition to the stuff they get to steal and keep anyway. I saw a great comic. To be fair, it's in the Zero Hedge coverage of the article. There's a TSA officer telling a woman, please remove your shoes so I can take them and sell them on eBay. Why, American Airlines is even offering low-interest bridge loans to strapped security workers. And in spite of, or probably especially because it goes against White House guidance, the People's Republic of California is making a point to bring more attention to the plight of transportation sexual abusers by encouraging them to file for unemployment. So concludes the piece, not only is the TSA the one agency that could force an end to the shutdown, but it's also the key agency, give me a break, in the political popularity contest right now. And a lot is at stake over its sterling reputation. I put the word sterling in there, folks, just to emphasize the hype. And just what does it say about a country when the most popular agency with the peons, at least according to the Ministry of Truth, is the modern equivalent of the Gestapo? So here's why I spent the time on the piece. While some are emphasizing the plight of the poor but vital government workers whose very job description violates the essence of the Bill of Rights in just about every way imaginable and a whole bunch you probably can't imagine and that the media won't report, others, arguably more cynical, are suggesting this is a time for extra vigilance. Because if there ever was an unconstitutional agency set for Operation Showtime, and remember Waco and the BATF? Yeah, they picked that name. It might just now this time be TSA. Just imagine how a false flag terror or hijacking event would play right now with the waystream media. Especially since it's almost like they've been greasing the skids for it. Vice President Mike Pence was on Fox News Sunday over the weekend. He, of course, talked about the so-called battle over the budget, and in particular, Trump's wall and the southern invasion, offering things like DACA that the Democrats once wanted, but they seem to want his head now, even worse. Pence also took aim at the explosive and now fully discredited BuzzFeed News report that the media was all agog over, implicating Trump in a scheme to lie to Congress, along with the breathless media coverage that followed it for nearly 24 hours until the witch hunter-in-chief Robert Mueller issued his first public statement in more than a year to actually repudiate it. And that, too, folks, should raise more than a few eyebrows. We'll come back there in just a minute. Even the Washington Post later reported that Mueller intended his rare denial to mean that the story was, quote, almost entirely incorrect, decrying the, quote, obsession of many in the national media to attack this president for any reason, for any allegation. Pence asserted that the problem was bigger than BuzzFeed, which has stood by its story in spite of the evidence, without offering any additional justification, and despite the extraordinary Mueller rebuke. And given the endless saga of leaks from various so-called insiders via fake news mouthpieces, your host is hardly alone in thinking there's probably more to this story than meets the eye. Remember, these same purveyors of fake news are breathlessly awaiting the Mueller report, knowing full well it'll not only enable them to impeach, but execute this president. And increasingly, that doesn't even sound like hyperbole anymore. And they seem to be willing to pull out all the stops to grease the skids. So is it just possible that the witch hunter-in-chief needed a last-minute boost to his pretty much destroyed credibility? How about if a major story came out that was over the top and Mueller actually came forward and defended the president? Well, that'd make him look like a really honest, good guy, and more importantly, objective when it really mattered. Nah, they wouldn't really be that duplicitous, would they? Why, next you'll be trying to convince me they're willing to suborn perjury and destroy evidence. Two. Having suggested all of that, let me finish this particular thread up with a couple more comments from Greg Reeve via Fox News on the Pence story. The vice president told Chris Wallace, quote, "It was remarkable what we saw happening for 24 hours in the media on the basis of the report that appeared in BuzzFeed. It's one of the reasons why people are so frustrated with many in the national media." But not to be upstaged, your basic unhinged socialist, South Carolina Democrat Jim Clyburn came forward, speaking on the same show, to respond to BuzzFeed and say, oh, no, au contraire. Evidently, any excuse for calling for the president's head is sufficient if you couch it correctly. Listen to this, folks. I don't think that my Democratic friends are in any way rushing to judgment because they qualified right up front. If this is true, said Clyburn. When you preface your statement with, if this is true, that, to me, gives you all the cover you need. Unquote. Well, if this is true, folks, that man kills and eats babies, well, at least it goes to show that the idiocy he's spouting here is consistent. And if this is true, that the socialists, in other words, will do anything to impeach, destroy, and, if necessary, kill this president, what does that say about the rule of law? Well, we'll talk more about that after the bottom of the hour break, because if anything, this was one of those weeks that showed, literally, that not only could the waste stream not be trusted to tell the truth about the law or anything else once connected to it, they don't even seem to lie about it very well anymore. But we'll start with at least one bright spot, even though this one comes from the United States Supreme Court and those 9 black-robed priests of another god that at least temporarily seem to have managed to find an acorn. In a decision, says the Zero Head summary, that's bound to trigger millions of snowflakes across America, primarily, though, concentrated in a few zones along both left coasts, SCOTUS has cleared President Donald Trump's administration to, at least for now, start barring most transgendered people from participating in the armed services. We're getting to the point, folks, where some people serve their country, other people get served by it. We might as well make that clear. But at least for today, there's a tiny bit less of that. In a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court put on hold lower court decisions, primarily from the Ninth Circus, that blocked the administration's planned ban of so-called transgender people from taking effect. By the way, back before political correctness took over the military and the deep state swamp, the term was gender dysphoria. And like club feet or a heart problem and any number of other mental or physical disorders, this particular dysfunction was disqualifying for the military. And you can probably guess, but Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and of course, by proxy probably, Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissented. It's not over yet. The case will now return to the Ninth Circus for further proceedings. And should the administration lose there, which is pretty much a lead pipe cinch, they can return to the Supreme Court for a definitive ruling eventually. By which time, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg Circus may be resolved as well. And unless there's been an assassination in the meanwhile, literal or political, that outcome is also not much in doubt. And we'll pick it up there after the bottom of the hour break. Second segment for this Saturday evening. I'm again your host, Mark Call, and let's talk some more about just how far gone the fake news, and along with it, the rule of law, has gotten. Let's start with this piece from Caitlin Johnstone that says, the waste stream media begs for trust. Yeah, you heard that right. After the latest debacle, which one you may be wondering? Well, she's talking about BuzzFeed in particular, the story I referenced before the break. It says, following what the WAPO has described as, quote, the highest profile misstep yet, well, that was last week, for a news organization during a period of heightened and intense scrutiny of what now passes for the press, mass media representatives are now flailing desperately as they attempt to argue why people should continue to place their trust in these inveterate waste stream liars, a.k.a. news outlets. Last Thursday, BuzzFeed News delivered the latest Russia bombshell to fizzle within just 24 hours of its publication. A pattern, she writes, is now so consistent, I've personally made a practice of declining to comment on such stories until a day or two after their release. This, of course, was a story that was so heinously bad, even the Mueller witch hunt ended up disavowing it, which may, of course, have been part of the plan all along. She notes that the print version of the New York Times covered the BuzzFeed report on its front page when the story broke, but the retraction and subsequent Mueller correction the next day was shoved back to page 11. This, she said, is not only journalistic malpractice, but for some other reasons as well, downright galling. All right, well, there's a whole lot more on that score, but basically she says there was reason enough already for any reasonable person to refrain from frenzied celebration. All right, she rehashes the story, I'm not gonna, but basically I do like this summary. This, she writes, is the behavior of a media class that's interested in selling narratives, not reporting truth. And yet, the mass media talking heads are still telling us today that we must continue to trust them. Hey, have we ever lied to you? Well, in the last 2.5 seconds? Said NBC's Chuck Todd in a tweet, those trying to tar all media today. No, we're not trying to tar all of you, Chuck, just the demonstrated multiple prevaricators. Anyway, they're not interested, he says, in improving journalism. No, folks, we know what's journalism and what's not. But protecting themselves, he said. There's a lot more accountability in media these days than in our politics. Oh, really? Boy, that's a really nasty comparison, isn't it? Well, folks, for my own part, I'd really far rather trust the average used car salesman, even if I can see the thing sitting there in a smoking heap. Says Caitlin Johnstone, more accountability in media than in politics, Chuck? Really? Accountability to whom? Mass media doesn't even have public elections. Well, of course, we don't even have honest public elections anymore in America with a K. Now, Caitlin Johnstone, who is no Trump fan, actually concludes this way. The mainstream media absolutely is the enemy of the people. Just because Trump says it doesn't mean it's not true. And the sooner people wake up from the perverse narrative matrix of the plutocratic media, the better. From investigative reporter Jack Cashill via The American Thinker concerning the other big media flap and revelation of prevarication. He calls it what the right should learn from the Covington Catholic flap. The first question he begins any conservative should have asked himself about a picture of a high school kid supposedly harassing an old Indian guy beating a drum was, why is this image newsworthy? The image, he continues, was newsworthy because the left said it was. They shaped the news. High school kids harass their elders on a daily basis. Even if the Covington kid was guilty as accused, other kids throughout America were doing far worse things to old people during this same news cycle. Mugging them, punching them. Hey, anybody remember the knockout game? And, of course, even killing them. And even if they were caught on video, which happens frequently, the media wouldn't show those incidents unless the left found them politically useful. They almost never are, and so they almost never do. And ultimately, this isn't new. It's just that it's gone completely over the top. He points out that even the so-called right has gone off the deep end when it comes to coverage and political correctness. For example, writes Cashel, the National Review's coverage of the Covington flap mirrors its treatment of the Trump presidency. Its editors, like those at the erstwhile Weekly Standard, have been playing by the left's rules since the National Review denounced the John Birch Society nearly 60 years ago, said one editor way back then. At the time, by way of explanation, quote, we can't afford to jeopardize the grudging status we've earned in the liberal community, unquote. And when grudging status with the left matters more than the truth, folks, you can kind of see why we are where we are. From there we go on to another guy that I find less and less respect for, as he too seems to have moved more and more in the direction of seeking liberal acceptance. Former Judge Andrew Napolitano and now Fox News senior judicial analyst who accused, and got this one right, the FBI of using unconstitutional means to obtain information against the newly elected President Donald Trump when he was on Fox and Friends on Tuesday. He said, one warrant is easy to get and one is difficult to get. So when the FBI can't get the more difficult one, they get the easy one. And he added, that has corrupted them. And that has enabled them to gather evidence by unconstitutional means, and that's what they did to the president, unquote. Which prompted even the real Donald J. Trump to quote the man and observe in a tweet that he was referring to the, quote, Clinton campaign's fake and unverified dossier, which is illegal. Said Napolitano, the president has argued that FISA, which has a low standard to get a search warrant, sick, has been abused by the FBI because it's easy to get a search warrant from a FISA court as opposed to a regular sitting federal judge where the standard is one of the Constitution. Under the Constitution, to get a search warrant, to listen to somebody's phone calls, to look at their mail, to follow them, you have to have probable cause of a crime, a very high standard. You have to show evidence, not a dossier, but actual evidence to a judge. He went on to say there's a political agenda within the FBI, gee, do you think, and claimed that certain agents clearly want to see the president and this White House fail. Quote, it's obvious that there was an agenda on the part of the people in the FBI to either cause President Trump to stumble, to prevent him from entering office, or to get rid of him once he was in office. We keep getting snippets of this evidence. If they can do this, he continued, to the President of the United States, they can do it to anybody, unquote. And I guess that, too, is increasingly obvious. There's this, too, a lamentation from a site called Liberty Nation about the fact that while Nancy Pelosi, the speaker for the traitors, may have thought she was clever when she sent the president a letter stating that the State of the Union address needed to be canceled because she doesn't want to hear from him, or because of security concerns, yeah, sure, she displayed her true priorities. She's obviously deeply concerned about her own safety and wants to build a wall around the important people in Washington, D.C., but not a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border to protect the American people, who she seems to kind of detest anyway. And said the author, there are a few political pundits who've pointed out this hypocrisy, and certainly the Republicans are nowhere to be seen. But one of the alternative media that's really risen to the top of the heap is conservative activist and stunt reporter Laura Loomer, who exposed Pelosi's hypocrisy in a humorous, nonviolent, and certainly memorable way, following in the footsteps of the legacy media to not only report the news, but to create it. Together with a film crew, we talked about this last week, but this reprise is kind of interesting, and some illegal aliens she had befriended, she climbed the wall on Pelosi's property in California and immediately discovered by security they were told to leave the premises. Loomer pricelessly responded that Pelosi had said that walls are immoral and that California is a sanctuary state, so she was just taking her hospitality at her word. And when the security guards then asked Loomer to show her ID, she brilliantly replied that according to Pelosi and the Democrat Socialists, IDs are racist. And when the guards then said she was trespassing on private property, she said, I'm a dreamer. I have every right to be here. And this is where I think he makes the interesting point. Where are the so-called Republicans? Because Loomer and others have now exposed the hollowness of their rhetoric. not to mention the impotence of the Republican Party as well. Why isn't Pelosi rightfully being challenged and ridiculed by the other major political figureheads for her incredible hypocrisy? The only one who does so on a regular basis, he says, is the master troller, the president. I do think Rand Paul gets in his licks. But, says Liberty Nation, that really is a shame, because the American people deserve better than Republicans who throw softballs, while the socialists throw dirt, rocks, and, yeah, they're working their way up to it, bullets. Maybe even nukes, if Swalwell, the California crat, gets his way. The other big news story of the week was the big lie, and subsequent CYA, about the Covington Catholic kids who were set up and accosted while they were waiting for their bus to pick them up at the Lincoln Memorial after they attended a Right to Life rally, who turned out not to be as big a racist as just about everybody else that had anything to do with the incident, including the press. It started with unscrupulously edited videos and a drum-banging, politically correct activist with a sordid past, although they still don't want to talk about that, escalated rapidly to nasty tweets from the knee-jerk left, and then threats of violence, even death, against the high school kids. Again, graphically demonstrating what real racism and bigotry in the name of tolerance looks like in post-biblical, post-constitutional, post-law America. And just like the lapdog European press is covering up the real incidents and causes of those incidents over there, it seems like the New York Times is doing their fake news part for the wannabe progressive workers' paradise here as well. I call your attention next to a puff piece dated January 23rd there from John Elegon about a nasty racist group that, if they were white, almost undeniably wouldn't be getting this kind of favorable coverage, or even objective coverage, from the Gray Lady. It went under the headline, Hebrew Israelites See Divine Intervention in Lincoln Memorial Confrontation. And it begins by saying they are sidewalk ministers who use confrontation as their gospel. Hebrew Israelites, and note, folks, they pointedly do not call them black Hebrew Israelites, any more than they'd miss a similar opportunity to call a similar group that wasn't the same color something like white supremacists, whether any group would use that terminology for themselves or not. Maybe there's a double standard here. Back to the story. Hebrew Israelites practice a theology that says God's chosen ones, black, Hispanic, and Native American people, have strayed and need to be led back to righteousness. So they post up on street corners in big cities, usually dressed this way and that way, blah de blah de blah. And they shout, use blunt and sometimes offensive language, and gamely engage in arguments aimed at drawing listeners near. That is, unless they're white. And I put that last part in there, folks, because you know the New York Times didn't. But it continues, their attention-grabbing tactics at the Lincoln Memorial resulted in spectacular consequences because the fringe theology landed in the national spotlight. After a viral video surfaced, at least in part, I note, of a group of, yes, black Hebrew Israelites profanely clashing with dozens of mostly white Catholic schoolboys wearing the infamous MAGA hats. And the New York Times admits that that video emerged, at least among the waste stream, only after shorter clips posted online showing the confrontation between students and a Native American elder, who turns out to have been an activist plant, initially led, as intended, to heavy criticism of the students, and basically, your host has to point out, because they certainly don't, wouldn't ever have shown up at all had not the alternative media pressed the issue and pointed out the incredible hypocrisy and outright lying here. But, continues the Gray Lady, for the Hebrew Israelites, it was a divine opportunity, because ordinarily those approached by the group quickly rush by, and you can guess why. And here follows quote after quote after quote from the racist but somehow still politically correct theologians, without any actual hardball questions either. The Times does get around to saying this, and imagine, folks, if this was being said about, say, oh, a KKK or so-called white supremacist group instead. Quote, the adherents contend that race doesn't exist, and so they group people instead based on what they call nations, believing that there are 12 tribes among God's chosen people. White people are not among those tribes, they believe, and will therefore be servants when Christ returns to earth. And gee, some of us might have thought servanthood was the whole point, but certainly not in the way that they or the New York Times seem to intend. And at this point, I turn to some pretty salient comments from Prison Planet's Paul Joseph Watson, who saw the piece, recognized it for the hypocrisy that it was, and noted that the paper completely ignores the fact that the group, quote, called the Covington kids white crackers, faggots, incest kids, while also labeling them future school shooters and telling an African-American student among them that they would harvest his organs. John Elligan's piece, painting the sympathetic picture that it does, allowed one of its members to characterize what they do as tough love. But in reality, says Watson, in addition to the racist and homophobic slurs the group was caught on camera hurling at the children, members are known to hold overtly disgusting views, to the point that even the far-left and generally unreliable Southern Poverty Law Center lists them as a hate group. And given their way over-the-top bias in favor of political correctness, to the point that even they can't whitewash this, that speaks volumes. And here we go. Watson notes that the SPLC listing them as a hate group warns that members, quote, believe that Jews are devilish imposters and openly condemn whites as evil personified, deserving only death or slavery, unquote. The New York Times, basically soft-pedaling the whole thing, does have to admit, though, that their favorite extremist group tracker, the SPLC, does characterize them as hate groups. But they opine that's, of course, in response to President Trump. And are you sitting down, folks? This is how this particularly egregious propaganda puff piece chooses to sum things up. And I'll quote it. To many black people, Hebrew Israelites are a harmless part of their community, said Todd Boyd, a professor of race and pop culture at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, where else? One of many cities where the group can be seen working the streets. More alarming to many African Americans, he said, is, quote, seeing a white guy in a Make America Great Again hat, unquote. And no, folks, I kid you not. This is what now passes for journalism at the New York Times as they try to pull a little bit of CYA after having been caught in both yellow journalism and racism on parade. And I'll follow that up with just one more reminder that fake news isn't limited to the Gray Lady and other members of the print and online media. The major network propagandists are up to their elbows as well. Covington High School junior Nick Sandman appeared on the Today Show in an exclusive, and as Harrison Smith of InfoWars put it, stood firm in the face of vitriolic propaganda aimed at him and refused to bow to leftist pressure. Nick Sandman, the piece begins, that Covington Catholic high school junior whose face-off, well, at least a teeny bit of it anyway, with a Native American elder on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial went viral over the weekend, is defending his actions and insisting he showed no insolence during the confrontation. Whoa, whoa, full stop. Good grief, folks. Given the situation, as it was finally revealed, what if he had? Snowflakes would have melted down, and the average Antifa guy would have probably hit the fellow in the face with a bike lock. All we've seen from this nice high school kid is evidently he was too well raised not to respect his elders, even when they're being, well, you know what's. However, continues Harrison Smith, the waste-stream media has relentlessly pursued their narrative that Sandman and his classmates were disrespectful, how dare they be, to this guy who was trying to be in their face and get his additional 15 minutes of fame, despite all kinds of video that later appeared showing the opposite to be true. And get this, folks, if I can get it out without gagging. Savannah Guthrie asked if Sandman thought he owed anyone an apology, and if he only realized that some people thought his smirk while he stood there and took the abuse was offensive. Full stop. And I have to ask, I wonder, did even one of these vacant-headed propagandist talking heads dare to ask a stupid, insolent question like that to, say, Mr. Camera Hog himself, the smirking, self-righteous David Hogg, after the Parkland incident, while he was out gunning for gun rights? And you know the answer. He was politically correct, as opposed to a target. It was not just Hogg's smirk that was offensive, it was his ignorance, too. But no, they wouldn't have said anything even remotely of the sort, because there was an agenda at play, and it would have cost them their jobs, even though he was white. Imagine that. And yeah, the point is, the hypocrisy here has gone way, way beyond the pale. It's in fact the lying and the twisting that is truly offensive. And meanwhile, these talking heads continue to smirk their way through the whole thing, and don't seem to think they owe anyone an apology. And that includes Jim the Accoster, too, or even realize some people think that what they do for a living is offensive. Well, where next, folks, but on to the socialist workers' paradise of, no, not California, but Venezuela, which is just a couple of years ahead of the People's Republic on the left coast, that ignorant, brain-dead Congress traitors, like Alexandria of the Occasional Cortex, see as the model for what they want to do to America. Turns out that's an apt comparison nowadays for more than one reason. Will there or will there not be regime change? Oh, and when it comes to election meddling, is it Russia, 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 or USA, USA? And it looks like the answer may be all of the above. In any case, things have been coming to a head for quite a while, but it escalated on Tuesday when protesters torched the Socialist Party headquarters of the PSUV, as it's called, District 23 in Caracas, and literally burned down a statue of communist dictator and El Jefe, the late Hugo Chavez. And the battle lines are being drawn between the former president and dictator, maybe, Nicolas Maduro, and the new guy who's being called interim president, Juan Guaido. Literally hundreds of thousands of his supporters have taken to the streets, and by midweek, the major tensions and escalations center around who will be recognized as the real president of Venezuela. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issued this statement, saying the United States stands with interim president Juan Guaido, the democratically elected National Assembly, and the people of Venezuela as they peacefully restore constitutional order to their country. We stand ready to support interim president Guaido as he establishes a transitional government and carries out his constitutional duties as interim president. Oh, and I do have to interject here that all this talk about constitutional duties really is ironic now, isn't it? Including determining the status of diplomatic representatives in the United States and other countries. And there's where the plot thickens. So two quick comments at this point. Wouldn't it be cool if the United States had stood with the interim president here and the constitutional government? Well, okay, that's not going to happen. Maybe point two now hits closer to the mark, because what's going on in Venezuela, folks, does seem to have certain striking resemblances and perhaps even some foreshadowing for the battle being engaged mostly behind the scenes between the deep state and the constitutional government here in the former republics. Although, arguably, there do seem to be quite a few more Venezuelans who understand what's going on than Americans, especially on both left coasts. Then on Wednesday, the communist Maduro regime, not giving up any more than the deep state, broke diplomatic relations with, among others, the U.S., giving American diplomats 72 hours to leave Caracas after President Trump declared Maduro's political opponent, Venezuelan National Assembly President Juan Guaido, as their interim president. When he said the following, quote, "The citizens of Venezuela have suffered for far too long at the hands of the illegitimate Maduro regime. Hey, maybe he ought to try locking him up. Might be easier than getting it done here. Today I have officially recognized the president of the Venezuelan National Assembly, Juan Guaido, as the interim president of Venezuela." That was seconded by Vice President Mike Pence. Guaido responded with a tweet of appreciation, and Maduro upped the ante by pulling a Pelosi. In the interim, at least 14 other countries have similarly recognized Guaido as their new president, including not just the U.S., but Canada, Brazil, Paraguay, Colombia, Argentina, Peru, Ecuador, Costa Rica, Chile, Guatemala, Panama, Honduras, Kosovo, and Georgia, which you'll note includes most of Central and South America with some notable exceptions. Both left-leaning Cuba and Bolivia in particular have expressed their support for Maduro. Mexico, say most reports, remains on the fence, at least for now. I guess they're too busy letting in the next group of migrant caravan invaders and getting them headed north. And perhaps most importantly, Russia, which may even have some bombers in the country, likes Maduro too. And they've threatened catastrophic consequences if the U.S. thinks about meddling in their election. The United States has refused to withdraw its diplomats from Venezuela, saying we will take appropriate actions if there's any harm that comes to them. And since the U.S. no longer recognizes the Maduro government, they don't respect his authority to kick diplomats out, nor break off diplomatic relations with the U.S. And I did see an interesting observation online from the Silver Doctors, who said, when it comes to Venezuela, the dust hasn't even settled yet. Furthermore, we don't even know if Venezuela's gold has perhaps already been melted down into brand new shiny 0.999 fine kilo bars. And that, at least, would be a story we've seen before now, wouldn't it? So while there may be war brewing on more and more fronts, ultimately, I guess you could say there's nothing new under the sun still.